This title is narrated with virtual voice, computer-generated narration for audiobooks. The First Continental Congress by Doug West. Preface. Welcome to the book, The First Continental Congress, A Short History. This book is volume 55 of the 30-minute book series, and as the name of the series implies, if you are an average reader, this book should take less than an hour to read. Since this short book is not meant to be an all-encompassing history of the First Continental Congress, you may want to know more about this pivotal moment in American history. To help you with this, there are several good references at the end of this book. I have also provided a timeline in order to link together the important events of the Congress and a section of the book titled Biographical Sketches, which includes brief biographies of some of the key individuals in the book. In the text, those individuals who are in one of the biographical sketches will have their name in bold print the first time they appear in the book. Thank you for purchasing this book. I hope you enjoy your time reading about the First Continental Congress of the United States. Doug West, June 2021. Introduction. Following the lead of the Spaniards, in 1607, the British established a foothold in North America with a fledgling colony in Jamestown in Virginia. For the next 150 years, English men and women immigrated to America, the new land of opportunity, seeking to build a better life. Along with the English came French, more Spanish, and Dutch colonists, hoping to expand their domains into this new frontier. Friction arose between the two arch-rivals, Great Britain and France, over trade and land rights in America, culminating in 1754 with the start of the French and Indian War. Though the English ultimately defeated the French, nearly driving them out of North America, the near-decade-long war left Britain deeply in debt. British statesmen believed that the colonies in America ought to bear a greater portion of the cost of administering and defending the colonies and began to impose new taxes. Here is where the troubles began between the British colonists living in America and the mother country. Britain, desperate to rebuild their treasury and fund the large contingency of British troops stationed in America, started to enact a series of taxes upon the colonists. Facing protests in the colonies, in 1770, the British Prime Minister Lord North repealed the recently introduced taxes on commodities, with one exception, the duty on tea. The new taxes were extremely unpopular in the colonies, as they felt that Parliament had no right to tax them, since they had no representation in Parliament. Lord North proclaimed Parliament's authority as a mark of the supremacy of Parliament and an efficient declaration of their right to govern the colonies. Many Americans were coming to grips with the reality that their rights and their liberties were being threatened by British power. In Boston, angry colonists organized and protested under the leadership of the radical Samuel Adams. By late 1773, independence was being openly discussed in colonial newspapers. As the British Crown under King George III and the Parliament under Lord North stiffened their resolve to control the American colonies, a confrontation between the British government and the rebels seemed to be an inevitability. As the embers of revolution smoldered, all that was required to set the flame was a spark, which came in the form of the Tea Act of 1773. This law was designed to keep the financially troubled East India Company from going into bankruptcy. Parliament threw the beleaguered company a lifeline in the form of granting them a monopoly on the sale of tea to the English colonies in America. What seemed like a straightforward act of government to rescue a major British company set off a series of events that brought delegates from 12 of the 13 colonies in America together in Philadelphia to form the First Continental Congress. The 56 delegates came together with the purpose of seeking redress for their grievances against their mother country. This is the story of how a small group of men, with quite different backgrounds, worked diligently to lay the cornerstone of the foundation of a new nation. Chapter 1. growing unrest in the American colonies over the Tea Act. The Revolution was effected before the war commenced. The Revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people. John Adams. Unrest stirred in the towns and cities that dotted the eastern seaboard of colonial America when the citizens learned that Parliament had enacted the Tea Act in May 1773. This act gave the London-based East India Company a monopoly on the sale of tea in the British colonies of North America. The East India Company was a major British company trading in commodities from the Far East and was in financial trouble. It held large stockpiles of tea stored in London warehouses that it could not sell. To bail out the company, Parliament passed the Tea Act to allow the company to dump its surplus tea on the American colonial market. In the colonies, most tea sold was smuggled in from Holland. The smuggled Dutch tea was cheaper than the British tea since it was effectively duty-free. Even though the tea from the East India Company was less expensive to the tea drinkers, the American tea merchants, both legal and the smugglers, would be seriously hurt by the cheap tea. With so many colonial merchants involved in the distribution and sale of tea, the new law potentially had significant consequences for their businesses. To add further upset to the colonists, built into the price of the tea was a small tax that went back to the British government. In September 1773, 7 ships laden with tea from the East India Company set sail for the port cities of Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Charleston. On October 21, 1773, the Massachusetts Committee of Correspondence sent a letter signed by Samuel Adams and Thomas Cushing to the other colonies urging them to be united in rejecting the tea bound for America. Adams, making a call for colonial unity, wrote in the Boston Gazette under the pen name Observation, proposing a Congress of American States be assembled as soon as possible. Draw up a Bill of Rights, choose an ambassador to reside at the British court to act for the United Colonies, appoint where the Congress shall annually meet. The Dartmouth arrived in Boston Harbor on Sunday, November 28, loaded with the hated tea. According to customs rules, within 20 days, duties on the tea must be paid and the cargo unloaded, or it would be impounded and sold for the unpaid duties. 2 more ships arrived a few days after the Dartmouth, also loaded with tea. Thomas Hutchinson, the British Loyalist governor of Massachusetts, ordered that the 3 ships be unloaded over the loud objections of the colonists. The radical group, the Sons of Liberty, of which Adams was one of the ringleaders, declared that anyone who aided in unloading or selling the British tea when it arrived would be considered as one of the enemies of America. The Boston Tea Party. December 17 was the day when the 20 days were up, and the tea had to be unloaded per the order of the governor. Anger was growing within the ranks of the patriots over the tea remaining in the port. On the night of December 16, the colonists decided to take matters into their own hands. Samuel Adams and fellow patriots held a large rally at Boston's Old South Church to decide what to do about the tea. When the meeting disbanded, a group of around 160 men dressed as Mohawk Indians marched to Griffin's Wharf, boarded the 3 ships, and without damaging the ships or assaulting the crew, proceeded to throw overboard over 300 chests of tea into Massachusetts Bay. The next day, Samuel Adams set to work writing letters to the other colonies, informing them of the happenings in Boston. "This is the most magnificent movement of all," exulted Samuel's cousin, the lawyer John Adams, adding, "This destruction of the tea is so bold, so daring, so firm, intrepid, and inflexible, and it must have so important consequences, and so lasting, that I can't but consider it an epoch in history." The British authorities were outraged with the episode, valuing the tea at a hefty £10,000 sterling. In Philadelphia and New York, the tea-laden ships were rejected by the colonists and forced to return to England with their cargo. In Charleston, the tea was unloaded and placed in a cellar where it remained until 1776. Figure, the Boston Tea Party. The Coercive Acts. As soon as word reached England of the Boston Tea Party, Parliament's retaliation was swift and decisive. Parliament issued a set of punitive laws they collectively called the Coercive Acts, which the colonists called the Intolerable Acts. The most economically crippling of the acts was the Boston Port Act, which closed the harbor starting June 1, 1774, until the city paid for the destroyed tea. The Act for the Impartial Administration of Justice let the royal governor transfer to England the trial of any British official accused of committing a capital offense in the line of duty, effectively making the British immune from colonial justice for serious crimes. The Quartering Act required local authorities to provide lodging for British soldiers in private homes if necessary. Lastly, the Massachusetts Government Act virtually annulled the colony's 1691 charter and gave the royal governor control over town meetings. In May, the civilian governor Hutchinson was replaced by General Thomas Gage, putting Boston under military control with 4,000 British troops, called Redcoats by the colonists, stationed in the city for enforcement. The British assumed the coercive acts would bring the colonists to heel. Instead, it galvanized their resistance. Sympathetic colonists up and down the eastern seaboard rallied to the cause of the besieged Bostonians, sending money, provisions, and boycotting British goods. Resistance grows throughout the colonies. Rumors of the British blockade of the Boston port had been circulating in Williamsburg, Virginia, for days. 2 weeks into the Virginia General Assembly session, the Virginia Gazette ran an article outlining the desperate state in Boston. Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, and a handful of the younger burgesses became alarmed, believing something must be done to alert Virginians of the British aggression. On May 23rd, they called a secret meeting and introduced a resolution calling for a day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer to occur on June 1st, the day the port of Boston was to be closed. Their purpose was to dramatize to the people the imminent danger inherent in the British actions in Boston. The governor of Virginia immediately dissolved the House of Burgesses, forcing the members to meet in private at Raleigh Tavern. The Burgesses denounced the closure of the Boston Harbor as a most dangerous attempt to destroy the constitutional liberty and rights of all North America, declaring that an attack upon one colony was an attack upon all. They called for a General Congress of deputies from all of the colonies to meet and deliberate on such measures as the united interests of America from time to time required. In mid-June, the Massachusetts House of Representatives resolved that a meeting of committees from the several colonies on the continent is highly expedient and necessary to consult upon the present state of the colonies. They recommended that a meeting of representatives from all of the colonies convene in Philadelphia on September 1st. Elsewhere, to coordinate the colonial response to the crisis, proposals came out of town meetings in Providence, Rhode Island, and the committees of correspondence in Philadelphia and New York for a general meeting of all the colonies. As word spread of the planned meeting, all the colonies except Georgia began the process of selecting delegates for the upcoming Congress. Even with the harsh treatment by the Parliament, most of the English living in the American colonies were loyal to the British Crown and had no desire to separate from their mother country. As the revolutionary writer John Dickinson put it in his popular set of essays, Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania, most English in America were bound to the crown by religion. Liberty, laws, affections, relations, language, and commerce. Some supported the actions of the British, feeling the willful destruction of the tea was an illegal act requiring a reckoning, while most hoped the crisis would just go away so they could get on with their daily lives. Many in the colonies were surely unaware of the extent of the British aggression in New England. Only the major newspapers in the largest of cities had significant circulation to spread the news deep into the hinterland, thus leaving many unaware of the distress of Boston. Chapter 2: Setting the Stage for the First Continental Congress. the distinctions between Virginians, Pennsylvanians, New Yorkers, and New Englanders are no more. I am not a Virginian, but an American. Patrick Henry. The people of Philadelphia warmly welcomed the delegates to the First Continental Congress as they arrived in the city. The delegates were from 12 of the 13 colonies. Only Georgia did not send any representatives due to its strong loyalist leanings. For most of the delegates, this was their first time traveling such a great distance from home. Many traveled for weeks to get to the city of brotherly love. Philadelphia, with 38,000 inhabitants, was by far the largest city in colonial America. New York City, with a population of 22,000, and Boston, with 17,000 people, were a distant second and third. Situated on the neck of land about 2 miles wide between the Delaware and Schuylkill rivers, Philadelphia was America's busiest port, with wharves stretching nearly 2 miles along the Delaware River. Ships outbound from the city carried lumber and wheat, Pennsylvania's chief exports. Ships from Europe and the West Indies brought finished goods, sugar, molasses, spices, and gunpowder. Philadelphia was unusual in that it had been a planned city, rather than just unfolding like most colonial cities. One of the delegates, John Adams, as he explored his new temporary home, recorded the layout of the city in his journal. Front Street is near the river, then Second Street, Third, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, Eighth, Ninth. The cross streets which intersect these are all equally wide, straight, and parallel to each other, and are named for forest and fruit trees, Pear Street, Apple Street, Walnut Street, Chestnut Street, etc. The delegates, 56 delegates in all, were chosen to attend the convention by the assemblies of each of the colonies. The distinguished group consisted mainly of middle-aged property owners, with several being very wealthy. Many of the men were well-educated, with degrees from European universities as well as Harvard, Yale, William, and Mary College, and other colonial schools. 19 future signers of a document yet to be written, the Declaration of Independence, were among the group, as well as 2 future presidents. The small group of men represented some of the best and brightest minds the colonial assemblies had to offer the Congress. Samuel Adams, one of the Massachusetts delegates, was known for his radical stance, and unlike the other delegates, was not wealthy or in a position of power. He had failed as a brewer and was the clerk of the Massachusetts Assembly. The last many years of his life were spent fostering the revolutionary cause and thinking little of building his own personal fortune. Joseph Galloway, a prosperous and polished Philadelphia lawyer who aspired to the leadership of the conservatives in Congress, summed up Samuel Adams as such: a man who, though by no means remarkable for brilliant abilities, yet is equal to most men in popular intrigue and the management of a faction. He eats little, drinks little, sleeps little, thinks much, and is most indefatigable in the pursuit of his objectives. Samuel's cousin, the lawyer John Adams, was also a Massachusetts delegate to the Congress. John, though lacking Samuel's fervor, was an ardent American patriot. Short and stout, with a bit of a paunch, John Adams loved to record the day's events in his diary. His diary, which he kept off and on for 50 years, has given historians insight into daily life in colonial America and the important events that defined the Revolutionary Era. His prolific writings throughout the Revolutionary period have been an invaluable source of first-hand accounts of some of the turning points in the formation of the United States. The Massachusetts delegation consisted of John Adams, Samuel Adams, and the 2 successful lawyers, Thomas Cushing and Thomas Treat Paine. According to John Adams' accounting of the journey, the men traveled in Cushing's handsome carriage along with 6 servants. When they left on August 10, 1774, New England was still hot and dry, transforming the compact highway into a choking, dusty thoroughfare. From Boston, the men traveled through Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, and finally arrived in Philadelphia on August 29. Along the journey, as they passed through the towns and villages, the men were greeted and welcomed by the local officials and the citizens. The delegates listened closely to gain the sentiments of the common man. Were they hardened revolutionaries? British loyalists? Or somewhere in between? In Hartford, Connecticut, they met with a delegate from Connecticut, Silas Deane, who declared, "The Congress is the grandest and most important assembly ever held in America. All of America is entrusted to it and depends upon it." In Philadelphia, one of the delegates from Delaware, Caesar Rodney, caught Adams' attention. He wrote, "Rodney is the oddest-looking man in the world. He is tall, thin, and slender as a reed, pale. His face is not bigger than a large apple, yet there is sense and fire, spirit, wit, and humor in his countenance." Rodney wrote of his fellow delegates, "All the seven delegates appointed for Virginia are here, and more sensible fine fellows you'd never wish to see. In short, it is the greatest assembly that ever was collected in America." Rodney went on to say many had condemned the Bostonians for their violence, but when he compared them to the men from Virginia, South Carolina, and Rhode Island, they were moderate men. Perhaps the South Carolina delegate Christopher Gadsden was the fieriest for liberty. Silas Deane wrote of Gadsden, "Mr. Gadsden leaves all New England sons of liberty far behind, for he is for taking up his firelock and marching direct to Boston." Gadsden confirmed that were his wife and children all in Boston, and they were to perish by the sword, it would not alter his sentiment or proceeding for American liberty. Three of the other Virginia delegates, Edmund Pendleton, Patrick Henry, and George Washington, did not arrive until Sunday, September 4th, the day before Congress was set to open. Though Adams was silent on their arrival, Deane recorded, "Pendleton was, of easy and cheerful countenance, polite in address, and elegant, if not eloquent in style and elocution. Patrick Henry was the completest speaker he had ever heard." Washington was a tall man of a hard countenance, yet with a very young look, and an easy, soldier-like air and gesture. Speaks very modestly and in determined style and accent. Washington had gained notoriety for his speech in the House of Burgesses, where he made the claim that he would fund, out of his own pocket, an army of 1,000 men and march them to Boston to counter the British. Washington was apprehensive about the British and the work of the Congress, writing to a friend before he left Virginia, "The crisis has arrived when we must assert our right. Otherwise," he warned, "the British shall make us tame and abject slaves, as the blacks we rule over with such arbitrary sway." Chapter 3, The First Continental Congress Begins. It does not take a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority, keen on setting brush fires of freedom in the minds of men. Samuel Adams. The meeting of the First Continental Congress opened on Monday, September 5, 1774, at Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia. The first order of business of the Congress was to choose a president, for which Peyton Randolph from Virginia was unanimously chosen. Next, Charles Thompson of Philadelphia was also unanimously chosen as the Secretary of the Congress. The presidency of the Congress was intended as an honorary, non-executive office with the duties of chairman. Randolph, the cousin of Thomas Jefferson, was a 53-year-old London-educated lawyer who had recently been Speaker of the Virginia House of Burgesses. According to Silas Deane, Randolph seems designed by nature for business. Of an affable, open, and majestic deportment, large in size though not out of proportion, he commands respect and esteem by his very aspect, independent of the high character he sustains. The new secretary, Charles Thompson, was a hardened patriot known as the Sam Adams of Philadelphia. Thompson had started his life in America as a 10-year-old orphan from Ireland who had worked his way up to become the headmaster of a school and then a prosperous merchant. Thompson would serve as Secretary of Congress up until the formation of the United States of America in 1789, witnessing firsthand the birth of a new nation. Figure, Carpenter's Hall as it appears today. Each of the delegates from their colonies had brought with them a letter with their credentials and a statement of guidance from the colonial assembly they represented. The letter was simply a note from the clerk, president, or secretary of the colonial assembly listing the names of their delegates and instructions given to them, expressing their colony's wishes for the Congress. Each of the credential letters was read aloud to the Congress. The reading of the credentials of several delegations was a reminder that the purpose of the Congress was not revolution. Rather, it was the redress of grievances and the restoration of harmony with Great Britain. Massachusetts, the epicenter of the controversy, instructed her delegates to consult upon the present state of the colonies and the miseries to which they are and must be reduced by the operation of certain acts of Parliament respecting America, and to deliberate and determine upon wise and proper measures to be by them recommended to all the colonies for the recovery and establishment of their just rights and liberties, civil and religious, and the restoration of union and harmony between Great Britain and the colonies, most ardently desired by all good men. Once the credentials were read, the question became how to vote on the issues before the Congress. The larger colonies argued that it was unfair that a small colony like Rhode Island or Connecticut be given the same number of votes as a large colony like Virginia. After the delegates realized it would be complicated and a hopeless process to base votes on the population of colonies, which would have been just a wild guess at that point, they decided that each colony would get one vote. The following day, the Congress took up the question again and decided on one colony, one vote. News from Boston and an opening prayer. Before adjournment of the second day, disturbing news arrived that the Redcoats had bombarded and burnt Boston. John Adams wrote in his diary that night, confused account but an alarming one indeed, God grant that it may not be found true. The next day, further news arrived confirming the rumored attack on Boston. An express arrived from New York, wrote Silas Deane to his wife, confirming the account of a rupture at Boston. All is in confusion. I cannot say that all faces gather paleness, but they all gather indignation, and every tongue pronounces revenge. The news from Boston gave credence to the more radical element within Congress that sought a more reactionary response to the actions of the British. Before the session closed on Tuesday, the delegates discussed having a prayer on Wednesday morning to open the session. One of the points of contingency with this idea was the number of diverse faiths represented in the room, leading to the question of what kind of minister should give the prayer. The group was a mix of faiths, with members from the Episcopalians, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, Quakers, and Anabaptist denominations. Samuel Adams, a pious man, though given to revolutionary fervor, rose and addressed the delegates, stating he was no bigot. He could hear a prayer from a gentleman of piety and virtue, who was at the same time a friend to his country. Adams moved that Reverend Mr. Deutsch, an Episcopalian clergyman, be requested to open Congress the next day with a prayer. That Wednesday morning, the delegates were in a state of dismay and confusion over the news, or maybe it was just an ill rumor, of the tumult in Boston. It was in that charged atmosphere that the good Reverend addressed the men that September morning. He opened with a reading from the 53rd Psalm. Plead my cause, O Lord, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me. Take hold of shield and buckler, and stand up for mine help. Draw out also the spear, and stop the way against them that persecute me. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation. After the reading, Reverend Deutsch proceeded with an eloquent prayer. I never, wrote John Adams on the impact of the prayer on the delegates, saw a greater effect upon an audience. It seemed as if heaven had ordained that psalm to be read on that morning. Silas Deane recorded his impression of the prayer. The Reverend prayed without book about 10 minutes so pertinently, with such fervency, purity, and sublimity of style and sentiment and with such an apparent sensibility of the scenes and business before us, that even Quakers shed tears. Figure, opening prayer of the First Continental Congress. The news of the bombardment of Boston turned out to be false. All that had happened was General Gage had begun to fortify the city, causing fear among the citizens. Though no blood was spilt, the rumor did serve to elevate the mood of the Congress. It was in this rarefied setting that Congress set to work, appointing two committees. The first one was to prepare a statement of rights of the colonies, detail the infringements on their rights, and determine the path to restore those rights. The second committee was tasked with reporting on the statutes that affected the trade and manufacturers of the colonies. The Suffolk resolves, on September 16, the courier Paul Revere arrived from Boston with a copy of the Suffolk resolves. With a ban on public meetings in Boston, delegates from Suffolk County, Massachusetts, which includes Boston, met in private homes in early September to plan resistance to the coercive acts. A committee headed by the Patriot leader, Dr. Joseph Warren, was charged with drawing up an address to Governor Thomas Gage and resolves to be sent to the Continental Congress. The document listed 19 articles that detailed infractions of the rights to which we are justly entitled by the laws of nature, the British Constitution, and the Charter of the Providence. The five key points of the resolves were: 1. They declared the coercive acts to be unconstitutional and not to be obeyed. 2. Since the British had dissolved the Massachusetts Assembly, Massachusetts should create a new assembly, collect all taxes, and withhold them from the Crown until the Massachusetts government is restored. 3. The colonists should arm themselves and form their own militias in preparation for a possible British attack. 4. The jailing of any Patriot leader by the British gave the colonists in turn the right to jail British officials. And 5. The document also recommended stringent economic sanctions against the British. Though the resolves were bold in their statements against the British, the authors professed loyalty to the king and did not threaten independence. The day after the Suffolk resolves arrived, Samuel Adams reported back to the Patriots in Boston that they were read with great applause before the Congress. Years later, when Joseph Galloway had become a loyalist and moved to England, he wrote in a pamphlet that he believed the Suffolk resolves were dangerous and the whole affair was orchestrated by Samuel Adams. Mr. Adams advised and directed to be done, and when done, it was dispatched by express to Congress. By one of these expresses came the inflammatory resolves of the County of Suffolk, which contained a complete declaration of war against Great Britain. The Suffolk resolves were applauded by some in the Congress. However, the defiant language of the document made many of the delegates extremely nervous. Action on the resolves would have to wait, as the Congress now turned its attention to the delegate from Pennsylvania, Joseph Galloway, who had a proposal on how to deal with Great Britain and the intolerable acts. Figure, mural from the U.S. Capitol building. The left painting shows a colonist paying taxes. The center painting shows debate among the delegates during the First Continental Congress. The right painting shows a British solider blocking the path of a woman and child, symbolizing British oppression. Galloway's plan of union. The more radical element of the delegates led by the New Englanders was opposed primarily by the Pennsylvania delegate Joseph Galloway and other sympathetic delegates. Galloway brought before the Congress a plan to change the basis of the relationship between the colonies and Great Britain. His, a plan of a proposed union between Great Britain and the colonies, was to form a separate American legislature called the Grand Council that would be elected by colonial assemblies. He proposed that the individual colonies continue to govern their own internal affairs, with the Grand Council regulating commercial, civil, and criminal matters that affected the colonies as a whole. The Grand Council would have the authority to veto parliamentary legislation, but would still be inferior to Parliament. Effectively, the Grand Council would be an inferior branch of the British Parliament. In addition to the Grand Council, his plan called for a President General appointed by the King to administer the government. Galloway's plan received a mixed review. It was strikingly similar to the Albany Plan, a proposal made by Benjamin Franklin at the 1754 Albany Conference. John Jay and James Duane of New York supported the plan, as did Edward Rutledge of South Carolina and others. The plan was probably doomed from the start, since the delegates were not empowered by their assemblies to establish a new form of government. Additionally, the plan would have impeded the rights of the colonial legislatures. The Congress voted on Galloway's plan for union, and it was narrowly defeated in a vote of 5-6. Galloway blamed what he called the violent party for his loss. Per the agreement of the delegates, only items that were successfully voted upon were included in the journals of the American Congress. Since the Galloway plan was not in the journal, details of the plan, discussions, and debates have come down through history by personal notes kept by the delegates, of whom John Adams was the most prolific. With the defeat of Galloway's proposal, Congress began mulling over the Suffolk resolves once again. They realized they had not gone far enough in supporting the cause of the beleaguered colonists from Massachusetts. On Saturday, October 8, the delegates voted in a show of support for Massachusetts as recorded in the journals of the American Congress, resolved that this Congress approve of the opposition by the inhabitants of the Massachusetts Bay to the execution of the late acts of Parliament, and if the same shall be attempted to be carried into execution by force, in such case, all America ought to support them in their opposition. Congress ordered that their resolution approving the Suffolk resolves, along with the resolves themselves, be printed for distribution. A further resolution was included that the colonies continue their contributions for supplying the necessities and alleviating distresses of our brethren at Boston. Declaration and Resolves. One of the goals of the Continental Congress was to write a clear statement of the rights of the colonists. The process was not as straightforward as it would initially appear. Never had a Western colony taken up the path of revolution in quite this manner, leaving no historical precedents as a guide. The 13 colonies were quite different places with a wide spectrum of peoples and needs. In the New England colonies, small family farms and towns were the norm, the soil was generally rocky, slavery was of a limited nature, and the British were beginning to aggressively oppress the people. In the southern colonies, large agricultural plantations growing tobacco, rice, cotton, and indigo dominated the society. The plantations relied upon the labor of hundreds of African slaves and indentured servants from Europe to function. The southern colonies tended to be more closely aligned with the British crown. This great diversity within the colonies made writing a clear statement of colonial rights a challenge. The committee that drafted the Declaration and Resolves based their statement of rights on the laws of nature, principles of the English Constitution, and the charters of the colonies. The section begins with that the inhabitants of the English colonies in North America, by the immutable laws of nature, the principles of the English Constitution, and the several charters or compacts, have the following rights. Resolved, N.C.D.1, that they are entitled to life, liberty, and property, and they have never ceded to any sovereign power whatever a right to dispose of either without their consent. Additional resolves followed that listed basic rights that were due them, including their right of assembly, right of petition, right of trial by a jury of their peers, the right to be free of a standing army, and the right to choose their own assemblies, all rights that were basic rights defined in the English Constitution. One of the questions that vexed the committee responsible for drafting the Declaration and Resolves was the limitations of the power of Parliament. Exactly how much authority did they have over colonies? John Adams, who was on the committee, wrote, "Indeed, the essence of the whole controversy. Some were for a flat denial of all authority, others for denying the power of taxation only. Some for denying internal, but admitting external taxation." In the end, the small committee completed their task, creating a list of colonial objections to the intolerable acts, a list of colonial rights, and an enumeration of their grievances with the mother country. a petition to King George III, Congress decided it would be wise to present their case to the other British North American colonies not present: Quebec, St. John's and Nova Scotia, Georgia, and East and West Florida. The letters explained the crisis with the British Parliament, encouraging each of them as fellow English colonists to join with the American colonies. The addresses were all prepared, reviewed by the members of Congress, and dispatched to the various colonial assemblies who had not sent delegates to the Congress. Ultimately, only Georgia would join with the struggling 12 American colonies in seeking their independence. In addition, Congress drafted a petition to King George III, informing him of the evil plot in Parliament to subvert the rights of the colonists and ensuring the king that with the successful repeal of the coercive acts, the colonies would restore friendly relations with Britain. The Congress appointed a committee consisting of Richard Henry Lee, John Adams, Thomas Johnson, Patrick Henry, and John Rutledge to prepare the address to the king. The committee chose the gifted orator Patrick Henry to prepare the draft. Henry turned out to be a much better speaker than writer, forcing Congress to demand a rewrite. John Dickinson, who had joined Congress very late, was known for his writing skills, so was given the task of preparing the petition. The petition listed a number of grievances against the Parliament and asked for a repeal of the coercive acts. By directly petitioning the king rather than Parliament, the delegates believed that the king was still the figurehead to be reckoned with to resolve their problems. Benjamin Franklin, who was in London as a colonial representative, delivered the petition to the Houses of Parliament. It wasn't until mid-January 1775 that the petition was presented to Parliament, who paid little attention to the document. Likewise, the king never responded to the Congress with a reply. Figure: first page of the petition sent to King George III by the First Continental Congress. Chapter 4: Formation of the Continental Association. Liberty, when it begins to take root, is a plant of rapid growth. George Washington. After Congress recessed for the day, usually around 3 in the afternoon, the delegates went their separate ways: to work on committee assignments, explore the city, ride home to their assemblies or families, or enjoy the hospitality provided by the prominent families of the city. Silas Deane wrote to his wife in mid-September, telling her of a lavish dinner at the State House and of his daily routine, writing, "Plenty of everything eatable and drinkable, and no scarcity of good humor and diversion. You will begin to suspect we do nothing else, but I assure you it is hard work. We meet at 9 and sit until 3, by which time we are unable to do anything but eat and drink the rest of the day." John Adams recounted his routine in Philadelphia to his wife. "My time is totally filled from the moment I get out of bed until I return to it. Visits, ceremonies, company, business, newspapers, pamphlets, etc., etc., etc. From 9 to 3, most earnestly engaged in debates upon the most abstruse mysteries of state. At 4, a dinner with some of the nobles of Pennsylvania, where we would feast upon 10,000 delicacies and sit drinking Madeira, claret, and Burgundy till 6 or 7, and then go home fatigued to death." He also detailed one of the lavish dinners he attended, describing the feast of turtle and every other thing: "Flummery, jellies, sweetmeats of 20 sorts, trifles, whipped syllabubs, floating islands, fools, etc., and then a dessert of fruits, raisins, almonds, pears, peaches. Wine most excellent and admirable. I drank Madeira at a great rate and found no inconvenience in it." The Continental Association. Out of the Congress came what would turn out to be one of the group's most important accomplishments: the formation of the Continental Association, or the Association. The Association was a system that brought all the colonies into a network to enforce non-importation. The term boycott did not yet exist, of British goods. The Articles of the Continental Association imposed a ban that began on December 1, 1774, on all goods from Britain, Ireland, and the British West Indies. As stated in the opening paragraphs of the Articles of the Association, to obtain redress of these grievances, which threaten destruction to the lives, liberty, and property of His Majesty's subjects in North America, we are of opinion that a non-importation, non-consumption, and non-exportation agreement faithfully adhered to will prove the most speedy, effectual, and peaceable measure. Since the 13 colonies were Britain's largest trading partner, a boycott of British goods would clearly get their attention. The debate over the non-exportation provision in the Association nearly caused a rupture of Congress. Article 4 of the Association document stated, 4. The earnest desire we have not to injure our fellow subjects in Great Britain, Ireland, or the West Indies induces us to suspend a non-exportation until the 10th day of September 1775, at which time, if the said acts and parts of acts of the British Parliament herein after mentioned are not repealed, we will not directly or indirectly export any merchandise or commodity whatsoever to Great Britain, Ireland, or the West Indies, except rice to Europe. The last four words, except rice to Europe, nearly brought the Congress to an abrupt end. Four of the delegates from South Carolina, Thomas Lynch, Henry Middleton, Edward Rutledge, and John Rutledge, laid down an ultimatum that, unless the South Carolina staples of rice and indigo were exempted from the non-exportation language, they would not sign the association. To prevent a breakup of the Union, a compromise was reached with the South Carolinians, which allowed the non-exportation of indigo, but did allow the export of rice to Europe. The crisis passed, and the delegates continued to work out the language of the association agreement. One of the articles in the association's charter established committees with the colonies to enforce the non-importation and stated that a committee be chosen in every county, city, and town by those who are qualified to vote for representatives in the legislature, whose business it shall be attentively to observe the conduct of all persons touching this association, and when it shall be made to appear to the satisfaction of a majority of any such committee that any person with the limits of their appointment violated this association. Universally condemned as enemies of American liberty, and thenceforth, we respectively will break off all dealing with him or her. These were very contentious words for the average colonist, effectively telling them they either comply with the directives of their local committees or become enemies of American liberty. The formation of the local committees to enforce the edicts of the Congress brought thousands of common people into the cause and formed a network of like-minded individuals in the colonies. Not everybody was happy with the many limitations placed on the colonists by the association. One such person, aggrieved by the new edicts, complained, "If I must be enslaved, let it be by a king at least, and not by a parcel of lawless committeemen. If I must be devoured, let me be devoured by the jaws of a lion, and not gnawed to death by rats and vermin." After the Articles of the Continental Association were finalized and approved by Congress, the delegates signed the final document, and 120 copies were ordered to be printed and distributed to the colonies. The association was an important step toward the creation of an organic union among the colonies. Though not at the level of the Articles of Confederation or the Constitution that would follow years later, it was in a true sense an instrument of union, and the first to be subscribed to by all the colonies that entered into the agreement. The end of the First Continental Congress. At the end of October, after just 7 weeks of discussion, the work of this group of distinguished men came to a close. One of the final acts of the Congress was to agree to meet again in May 1775 if their grievances were not addressed. Since the petition to the king and work of the Congress would take at least 6 weeks to reach London, May 1775 would be enough time for the British to respond. Now the delegates dispersed back to their own colonies to deliver the messages from the Congress to the colonial assemblies. Ever the faithful diarist, John Adams recorded in his diary a hopeful note about his time in Philadelphia. "Took our departure, in a very great rain, from the happy, the peaceful, the elegant, the hospitable and polite city of Philadelphia. It is not likely that I shall ever see this part of the world again, but I shall ever retain a most grateful, pleasing sense of the many civilities I have received in it, and shall think myself happy to have an opportunity of returning them. Oh, how very wrong Mr. Adams would prove to be regarding his belief that he would never return to this part of the world again, for in just a few short months he would return to Philadelphia with a world of troubles upon his shoulders. All the assemblies from the colonies, except New York and Georgia, adopted the association. Even in these two reluctant colonies, local committees formed and went about the business of the association with only the sanction of the General Congress. Chapter 5. Aftermath of the Congress. Timid men prefer the calm of despotism to the tempestuous sea of liberty. Thomas Jefferson. In late 1774, the implications of the Continental Association Agreement were starting to be felt within the colonies. The committees of inspection that were responsible for the enforcement of the non-importation mandate of the Congress became effective in carrying out the inspection for imported British goods. In New York in 1774, they imported roughly 370,000 pounds of goods from Britain. In 1775, that number had dropped dramatically to 1,000 pounds. As the British continued to bring more troops into the Boston area, tensions between the colonists and the redcoats escalated. The colonials who were loyal to the crown, known as the King's Friends or Friends of the Government, found it increasingly hard to remain neutral. Those loyal to Britain were viewed with suspicion and were ostracized by the rebels and patriots. The forced inspections of purchases dictated by the Continental Association irritated many, claiming the fight for American liberty was curbing the liberties of individuals. One loyalist wrote that the only liberty the patriots sought was of knocking out any man's brains that dares presume to speak his mind freely upon the present contest. Choosing to remain loyal to the British crown in the middle of a growing resistance movement had its consequences. It put your livelihood, property, and sometimes your personal safety at jeopardy. As people were forced to choose sides, friendships ended and families were torn apart. The English response. As word reached Britain of the entreaties of the Continental Congress and their boycott of British goods, members of Parliament and King George III became more determined to break the backs of the rebels in America. The New England governments, proclaimed the king, are now in a state of rebellion. Blows must decide whether they are to be subject to this country or independent. More British troops were sent to North America to squash the nascent rebellion before it got out of hand. In February 1775, Parliament declared that Massachusetts was in a state of rebellion, and it endorsed the King's intentions to take the most effectual measures to enforce due obedience to the laws and authority of the Supreme Legislature. In addition, Parliament denied the New Englanders access to the North Atlantic fisheries and restricted trade outside the colonies. Later, Parliament imposed the same sanctions on Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland, Virginia, and South Carolina, which were considered to be supporters of Massachusetts and the Continental Congress. As the fear of an impending war swept the colonies, people began to prepare for this grim inevitability. In Virginia, the eloquent Patrick Henry delivered a prophetic speech to his fellow burgesses. The next gale from the north will bring to ears the clash of resounding arms. Though the exact words of his speech were not recorded, his closing statement, "Give me liberty or give me death," became the rallying cry of the revolutionaries. On the fateful morning of April 19, 1775, on Lexington Green in Massachusetts, a small band of colonial minutemen, mainly farmers and their sons, faced off against hundreds of British regulars. Shots were fired, lives were lost, and an 8-year struggle for the independence of the American colonies against the most powerful army in the world had begun. This title was narrated with virtual voice.